This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Leadership Institute at Purdue Northwest is starting off an interesting series, which they are entitling Leadership in Action. It's a seminar series, that the first of which will get underway tomorrow, Thursday, the 7th of November. It begins at noon with a luncheon and continues on through the afternoon, and it'll be held in Portage. With us to talk about this event and a lot of other activities, too, that the Leadership Institute at Purdue Northwest is revamping, we have Professor Rachel Clapp-Smith. She's professor and chair of the Department of Managerial Studies at the Purdue Northwest College of Business. And one of the other hats that she gets to wear is that of academic director for the LNI at Purdue Northwest. And Professor Smith, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Give us an idea of the thoughts in creating this very first Leadership in Action seminar series, and then we'll get into some of the real movers and shakers that are going to be on this panel discussion. But first, tell us about the organization that led into putting this this very interesting seminar series together.
Absolutely, thank you. It really started with how do we develop the Leadership Northwest Indiana program to help our leaders get a regional mix, a regional understanding of the challenges and the opportunities in the region, so that as they're developing their own leadership capacity, they're finding opportunities to engage and making a change in the region. So it seemed pretty natural that we would have representatives from various cities, having all the counties of the region represented, to get a regional mix and have an understanding of civic engagement in the region and some opportunities presented there. So as part of putting this session together, we will be doing leadership content in the morning with our LNI participants around authentic leadership. And then in the afternoon, this is kind of our standard operation, is to have someone from the region come in to talk about a topic that's relevant. And we realized we had such a great lineup of speakers that wouldn't this be interesting to people beyond just our group of LNI participants? And so that was a little bit of the thought process behind it. And as we started speaking to others, people are interested in coming to see these four speak.
And the rundown here with the list of participants for the panel discussion basically comes off the results of the municipal election yesterday. We have a man who's a former state lawmaker who's now just been elected mayor of LaPorte. We have we had the person who was expected to be the mayor-elect in Gary, and of course we have a senior mayor here in Northwest Indiana, of Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura. And of course, we're referring as well to Tom Dermody. He's the fellow that just got elected as LaPorte mayor, and mayor-elect Jerome Prince from Gary. And you also have, too, a state senator, I know, that from Northwest Indiana, who's going to be involved not only in the legislature, but also she's running for another public office, I guess, in 2020. Tell us first more about the panelists that you got together, and also, too, about the facilitator, who's an interesting person in her own right.
Yes, absolutely. I really have to credit Sheila Matthias-Brilson. She's so visionary in how we move the Leadership Institute forward. And so as we were brainstorming, who might we attract, or who might we have in this panel, We really did think about, we were mindful of the fact that it is around election time and that this could be very interesting to speak with people at this time of the year. And we're also really fortunate that we have as an instructor in the College of Business, Reagan Hatcher, who is also a state representative for Indiana. So she'll be facilitating the conversation we have with the four panelists. It'll be really a great opportunity to hear about their leadership experience, and as well as what's going on in their particular area of the region.
Now, this event's going to be taking place at the Leadership Institute of Purdue at Purdue Northwest, which is in Portage. It's 6100 Southport Road, which also happens to be the address for NERPC's headquarters as well. And a lot of people coming together for this event have to have arrangements made ahead of time. And obviously, you have lunch, so you had to make reservations, or at least you had to let get an RSVP list going so people will know to let people ahead of time know that you're going to be there.
Yes, yes. Please, so that we know that we have a lunch waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can RSVP by visiting the Leadership Institute website or calling on the number, just 219-989-2808.
Now, I know some time back when Sheila Matias had made the announcement came out that she had become the new executive director for the Leadership Institute at Purdue Northwest. She was talking about a number of programs with us that she wanted to get updated, kind of bring into the 2020s, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
One of those in particular was what is has been known for years as the SLICE program. And I guess because you're the academic director, you get to help administer that. Tell us about this 2020 Young Leader Academy program that is going to take the place of the old SLICE program. And I know now that they've got an opportunity for enrollment for any young people that are interested in getting involved.
Yes, we've just announced enrollment. The application is now open, and we're really interested in hearing from young leaders from the region who might be interested in enhancing their own leadership capacity. So the program is 6 sessions. It'll begin in January. And the students will come to our facility in Portage, and we'll really spend a full day with them working on their leadership skills. And also, we will have them work on, we're going to thread, because it's a particularly interesting year to look at leadership from multiple lenses, particularly from a civic engagement perspective, there's a lot of content that's happening in real time that we'll be able to leverage. But really, we're looking at helping the students figure out how to self-lead, and we'll be using authentic leadership development theory as a foundation for this whole idea around self-management. We'll also help them build certain interpersonal skills, and so we'll also look at servant leadership theory as a way to provide the evidence-based foundation for what we'll be doing in that segment. And then our third bucket is about professional skills. And as a leadership content to undergird the professional skills will be charismatic leadership theory. So we have a lot of fun activities planned for this and some wonderful speakers that we're lining up. So it's going to be an amazing experience and really rebooting the program to have a lot of evidence-based leadership research behind all the skills and abilities that we're going to help the students build.
Is the intent of this program, the 2020 Young Leaders Academy that's being revamped and being set up here, is this akin to the ongoing programs that have been going on through the Leadership Institute over the years where you get adults, basically, from pretty much all walks of life, certainly all facets of business and community service in Northwest Indiana together for the regular classes and visiting and instruction and things? Are these,
yes,
is this very much similar? Or maybe it's a logical move into that when a high school student goes into college and goes into a professional life where it may happen to be, and they get to kind of follow through.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, leadership happens at every stage of life. Anytime two or more people are in a room together, leadership emerges. And so what we're really helping the students do is build a foundation that's relevant for where they are in this stage of life. But the other programs we're running are also geared towards helping people build capacity that is then appropriate for their particular stage of life. So what's fantastic is that leadership is something that applies across all areas and functions of society. And the more we have people empowered to feel as though they can have an impact and make a positive change within their communities, regardless if they're 18, 40, mm-hmm. or 68, there's always an opportunity to improve leadership. It's a never-ending journey, which is what makes it so fun.
Well, certainly, if you're interested in this Leadership in Action seminar series that gets underway on Thursday the 7th at the L&I office in Portage, be sure to RSVP today and let the folks there at the office know that you want to be there for lunch and be participants, be at least involved in the panel discussion and have a chance to ask some questions, I'm sure, from some of the speakers that are going to be involved. Do it today because the opportunity coming up tomorrow is going to disappear. There'll be more in the future, but you'll want to take advantage of this very first Leadership in Action seminar series, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Professor Smith, thank you very much for joining us and talking about both the programs, not only the program coming up on Thursday the 7th, the very first Leadership in Action seminar series, but a little bit more about the 2020 Young Leaders Academy that's being established there at L&I Purdue Northwest. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
Professor Rachel Clapp Smith is the she's the chairman of the Department of Managerial Studies for the Purdue Northwest College of Business, and she's also the academic director for the Leadership Institute at Purdue Northwest. Athletics associations all across the country have been complaining about a shortage of sports officials for years, and Indiana's no exception. And the shortage isn't particularly drastic among women. Many point to fan behavior as a key issue, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports that some of the challenges that they face to get the job done just cannot be solved with just better sportsmanship alone.
You won't see many women working games on the high school football fields in Indiana, but if you do, it's probably Holly McCamick.
So I've done football for 3 years, 5 years for volleyball and track.
McCamick is one of about a dozen licensed female high school football referees in the entire state. She started doing this job after her kids graduated to stay connected to schools, kids, and sports. But it can be tough. She says she's still getting used to how angry people from the crowd can get about her calls.
It's one of the things that's been most shocking to me, actually. You know, people who officiate are doing it because they want to give back to the game.
And that's not all she has to worry about. Right now, she's working with a broken leg after a run-in with a football player during a game she reffed last month. McCamick's concern about fan behavior is the most common complaint among referees, according to Sandra Walter. She's the assistant commissioner of the Indiana High School Athletic Association, or IHSAA.
We are dismissing, when I say we, the officials, are finding it necessary to remove fans at a rate that is 25% higher this year than last year. And I will tell you, last year, that removal was 43% higher than 17-18.
Angry fans have followed officials to their cars or made verbal threats. Other things stack up too, though, like travel, buying uniforms and training, and often a select handful of people decide who gets assigned to the high-stakes games. When the economy is good, Walter says, it's tougher to convince people to deal with all of that for a paycheck that might not even break even with the costs. And many officials are walking off the field for good. The IHSAA has just over 5,000 officials this year, compared to nearly 7,000 3 years ago. So why does this matter? Walter says lessons kids learn in sports stay with them for life.
We're talking about how to get along with others. Teamwork, cooperation. You tell me one area in your adult life where that's not necessary.
None of that can happen without referees. And remember that roster of more than 5,000 officials in the state? Fewer than 600 of them are women. Walter says working moms worry about missing out on family time. McCamick was a stay-at-home mom and didn't start officiating until her kids moved out. But even when women do take the job, finding gear made for them can be impossible.
There's no place that will sell a woman's football uniform to officiate.
And McCamick says getting more women on the field can show kids what equality looks like.
Not having women in these roles sends a message that women are not strong enough to hold a role of that prestige or of that importance.
The complexities behind the shortage has more people taking a closer look at the problem to find solutions. A class of sports management students at IUPUI has been researching different challenges officials say contribute to the shortage. Chris Seymour's group is looking at the role of the assigner, the ones handpicking officials for high-stakes games and tournaments. He says a lack of transparency can result in bias or favoritism for who gets to move up in the industry, and that can be really frustrating.
We actually had an NBA official come to our class and speak to us, and he said that it was easier for him to become an NBA official than it was to officiate a state finals.
And while they focus on some of the bigger, more technical answers, football ref McCamick says a fairly simple but essential place to start is just empathy.
Without officials on the field, we're not going to have education-based athletics anymore.
Because even in uniform, she says, she's human too. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Ms. Ann Anderson, Director of Economic Development for the City of Hammond. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. Very happy to be here.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your role with the City of Hammond, Ann.
Okay. I am the Director of Economic Development for the City of Hammond. So in economic development, we assist companies, large and small, who are looking to relocate to Hammond, or if they're already in Hammond, relocate within the borders or expand their footprint. So anything that has to do with companies that want to be here in Hammond, we assist them and make sure everything goes as smoothly as possible.
So your walkable downtown and transit-oriented development plan is getting a lot of attention these days. So how did this proposal come about?
Well, because of the strong leadership of Mayor McDermott and all the quality of life initiatives he has been implementing in his 4 years as a mayor, Hammond has become pretty attractive to companies and developers looking to move here. Also, the proximity to Chicago and Lake Michigan makes it very attractive as well. So Hammond is doing really great on its north border and the south border near the expressways. But our downtown area has struggled to retain businesses and people for years, like so many downtowns across the country have. Last year, Mayor McDermott challenged us to think outside the box and perhaps find a consultant who could come look at our downtown from an outside perspective and work with us to create a vital core again.
So what are some of the key elements of this proposal?
Well, while there are many elements that are being considered for this plan, which I must say, right now it's still in the draft form.
Okay.
So we haven't received the final yet, but we're getting excited. I do feel that there are three key elements to the upcoming plan. The first is the obvious one, which is the Westlake Corridor train project and the proposed station that Mayor McDermott has proposed to build in the downtown area. Now, this proposed downtown station is not in the current scope of work for the Westlake. This would be an addition to, paid for and built by the city itself. But Mayor McDermott recognized how this train project will benefit all the communities that the train is going to travel through. So he really wanted to spur some additional development downtown. The second key element, I think, is the potential for residential in Hammond's urban core. Studies have shown that the market will now support residential down there, especially for the young professionals, the millennials, and empty nesters. So we have the potential for both new construction in downtown and also for rehabbing vacant buildings down there. So we will have a variety of housing options for people to look at downtown. And last, I would say the key element would be the rebuilding of Homan Avenue. It's our main thoroughfare downtown, and in places it is 4 and 5 feet wide with lanes, which it's big enough to handle, more than big enough to handle the 15,000 cars that drive through it. So the plan is recommending creating a more plaza-like main street for Homan, slowing the traffic down and making visitors and residents feel welcome to stay and walk around our downtown.
So we know being able to ditch your car to walk or take public transportation helps reduce emissions and air pollution. Is that part of the plan or the message promoting the plan?
Mm-hmm. Well, being that this plan centers around walkability, mm-hmm. Which the designers are really pushing for our downtown, it's kind of a natural result of the plan. Having a transit-oriented development in downtown will support the idea that people will hop off the train in the evening after sure. work. They'll go and pick up their dry cleaning, hit a yoga studio for a class, and then pick up groceries for dinner mm-hmm. or hit a new restaurant down there, all without getting into their cars. So absolutely, Wonderful. That does definitely mm-hmm. supports that.
So where's the city of Hammond at the timeline for this project, and mm-hmm. then what's next after that?
So we're getting close to the end of receiving the downtown master plan. Mm-hmm. Jeff Speck and Associates, he is the designer and urban developer that we have hired to create this plan. He is working on the final plan now. He sent us a draft about a month ago, sent it out to our team, and we got to look through it to give some final comments mm-hmm. and corrections. He has received those comments and is working on it. The draft plan is coming to back to Hammond on November 20th, and we'll have a public presentation to present it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So how can our listeners learn more about this project and some of the other initiatives that Hammond has?
Excellent. I would say the best way to keep updated on what we have going would be through a good landing platform would be our website.
Okay.
Our website is gohammond.com. I'm in the Economic Development Department, but under the first page, we have latest events.
Okay.
We'll have this public presentation posted. Mayor McDermott often talks about it on his radio show on WJOB on Friday mornings. Mayor's Nights Out are mm-hmm. a good way to learn more about it. But we will live stream our public presentation in November, on November 20th. That will be on gohammond.tv. It'll then be archived for future viewing.
That's
so
wonderful.
Anyone can check it out there.
A lot of great information, Ann.
And, thank you.
Thank you for being on. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Ann Anderson, Director of Economic Development for the City of Hammond. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Thank you, Carl. Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And of course, all of the Green Fleet Radio conversations are on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. As we approach Veterans Day, it's an opportunity to remember and to honor veterans of all of the armed forces of the United States, and in particular, those that have stories to tell. These are people that are witness to pretty historic events. It doesn't matter whether it happened to have been seen from the foxhole or from a cockpit of an aircraft, maybe seen from a ship deck, or maybe even from a mess deck, or even still from a behind-the-scenes office desk. They're all stories that deserve to be told and to be chronicled. And that's what the Veterans History Project is all about. And we have with us the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, now retired, Colonel Karen Lloyd. And Colonel Lloyd, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me. Very much appreciated.
If you will, please take a moment and talk a little bit about the Veterans History Project. How did it get started, and what are some of the general goals that you have?
Well, the Veterans History Project was started in October 2020. It was led by Representative Ron Kine, who had the idea based on a picnic he had the previous summer with his family when his dad and uncle got together and started talking about their story. And he said, you know, who else out there needs to know these stories? Mm-hmm. And the Veterans History Project really relies on volunteers like your listeners to reach out to the veterans in their lives and their communities to find out what they did, whether it was humorous, whether it was harrowing. It's these stories that are lost to history unless we find out what they are and get them somehow jotted down or listened to and recorded. And that's what we're all about, helping your listeners, volunteers, reach out to those veterans who would otherwise be lost in plain sight.
What do you see as the reason why veteran stories seem to be our stories in general?
I think veteran stories are our stories because they help us understand that these are folks from across all backgrounds, experiences, walks of life, and they have served our country, and they really prove why freedom's not free.
Now, we know that many times this is an opportunity for folks to do a little research, not only about individual research into a family member or maybe somebody from the community that they live in, but just in general, researchers taking advantage of this. How does the collection is able to be used as a research tool?
Well, the collection is used by a variety of different folks. I mean, two that really come to my mind. One is Ken Burns when he did his World War II documentary back in 2008, mm-hmm. and then again when he did his Vietnam documentary in 2017. Both times he used over 200 of our collections to look at stories and listen to stories to see which stories he wanted to use. But what I like best about it is that the veterans keep their copyright with our program, so that Ken Burns had to reach out to these veterans or their heirs and say, I'd like to use your story. Here's how I'd like to use your story. Are you up for it? Another really good example would be Liza Mundy and the book that she wrote, Code Girls, the World War II women who were told, oh, well, just tell them you're a government secretary, and they were the ones that were breaking the codes. And what I'm most pleased about is Liza said, if not for your research librarian and for the materials you had here at the library, I would not have done this book because I wouldn't have thought I had enough materials. And what I'm most pleased about is that last March, we actually had the first national Code Girl reunion here at the library, and we had six Code Girls in their mid-90s come, along with over 40 family members.
Wow.
To talk about what their loved ones did during the war.
Take a second and explain to our listeners, if they're not familiar with the term Code Girl, what does that mean?
Code Girls were the women that were asked, are you going to be engaged, and are you good at crossword puzzles?
Mm.
And if they weren't going to be engaged and they were good at crossword puzzles, they were breaking the codes. One of the codes that they broke was the Japanese purple box, which allowed us to be successful at Midway. And these women didn't talk to each other. Some of the stories that Liza shared with us that I absolutely adore was she said her husband and her children and her went into an intelligence museum, a spy museum, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and they saw a purple, this coding machine. It was the Japanese equivalent of the Enigma. And she said, oh, well, I guess I can tell you what I did during the war. And his husband says, well, dear, you were a government secretary. And she said, no, Harold, here's what I really did. So she explained to Harold and their grown children what she had done during the war breaking codes, and she had never shared that before because she felt like if she did, that she would go to jail.
Wow.
And there's a whole group of women whose stories went with them to the grave because they didn't believe they could tell their stories. And we're so grateful for the few that chose to do that. We have over 20, and Liza found even more. But what they did was absolutely amazing, and they got absolutely no recognition for it. They're starting to get recognition now, which is so rewarding to me.
Now, we talked a little bit about the collections that are there available in the Veterans History Project and people that can take advantage of it. First, let's talk first about how veterans and Gold Star families can kind of add to their stories from the collections.
Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned Gold Star Families. 2 years ago, well, and actually 3 years ago in 2016, the end of 2016, Congress passed a law that allowed us to increase our mission to include Gold Star Families so that we can now hear from the loved ones of those that pay the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
We have 79 collections now, and it's growing daily. What I'm most pleased about is on Friday we had Navy Senior Petty Officer Keith Sherman, who has been going around the country, and he's collected a Gold Star family story from every state, and he chose to donate them to us here at the Library of Congress and the Veterans History Project, and we couldn't be more pleased about that. And your viewers can go up loc.gov/vets or our email site, vohp@loc.gov, to learn more about what we're doing and email us if what they see there isn't what they want. We will reach out to folks across the nation and provide, at no cost to them, a trained oral historian to help them gain a new skill set. We also have field kits that say how to do it. And if you have a tablet or a smartphone, you're halfway there. And we also have sample questions so that people will have a sense of, you know, how do you do an interview? What are the questions you should be asking? Some of my favorite questions, quite frankly, as a part of that arc of the story, is when you ask the veteran, so how did, one, why the heck did you sign up? And then followed by, so how did you get from home to that first duty station? And for some vets, it's the first plane ride, train ride, or bus they ever took. And then the most fun, quite frankly, is when you say, and who at that first duty station made the biggest impression on you, made a difference in your life? And they all remember the name. They all say, oh, my God, Sergeant Brown. And then they'll go and talk about it, and their eyes light up because it's something that they probably haven't talked about in an awfully long time.
Well, Colonel Lloyd, thank you for the information. Once again, give us the web address so if anybody wants to find out more about not only what's out there, but also to be able to get the information and contribute to it. What's the address for the Veterans History Project?
Yes, our website is loc.gov/vets. With an S.
And we've been talking with retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd. She is the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, which tells stories because veteran stories are our stories, too. Well, we're into the holiday season, or will be pretty soon. We may find many of the settings for holiday gatherings where both food and conversation are plentiful out there, but it's very important that we keep kids in mind. And, of course, that's why we return to the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, the IYI, Tammy Silverman, to talk more about it. It's one of the topics for her monthly conversation that's out there. And, Tammy, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Well, it's very important that we, of course, think about the youngsters when we're not only doing the meals, but also the interactions at the dinner table or after the dinner. Tell us why it's so important that youngsters be kept in mind.
Of course. So mealtimes, whether there are these big holiday gatherings or just weekday dinners, are a great time for family members and those little kids to catch up on events of the day. It's a good time to provide them support, discuss news, always kid appropriate, right? Tell stories, solve problems, you know, just kind of joke around and plan for your week. It's one of those things that we know leads to strengthening families, improved nutrition, and actually facilitating child development.
Oh, well, how does it seem to help youngsters? We'll start first with the ones that are preschool even.
Right. So even the young kids, we know that dinner time conversation has a big boost on vocabulary, even more. This was a little surprising in the research to me, even more than reading to those kids. So because they get different words than what they get out of their storybooks. So what they call the rare words, there are 1,000 of them at the dinner table compared to only 143 from storybooks. So that larger vocabulary really helps them to read earlier and more easily.
Now, when you get to past that, get into kindergarten and beyond, what are the advantages of getting the youngsters together and talking there at the dinner table or afterwards?
Well, it's one of those things that people might not think of, but regular mealtime is a higher predictor of high achievement scores in school than time spent in school, than doing homework, playing sports, doing art, any of those other things. Actually having those regular mealtimes helps those young kids in a variety of ways.
Now we talk about now into the high school and maybe even beyond into college age. If you have the people back from college during the Christmas and during the Thanksgiving seasons, of course, too, what importance is there to get them involved in the conversation?
Yes. So regular family dinners are linked to a lower risk of teenage, a whole bunch of negative behaviors such as suicide, smoking, binge drinking, marijuana use, violence, eating disorders, sexual activity, all of those things, and particularly families who eat meals together 5 to 7 times a week. And they're also more likely to get A's in school than families who aren't able to eat dinner together all that often.
Now, I know that we have the Thanksgiving meal, the big feast that comes up here where the families gathered around to eat. And then, of course, maybe some of the adults are headed off to the other room to watch the football game. That actually has some redeeming social value, too, does it not?
Absolutely. And so it's important that a child feels connected to their family. So those social connectedness, those rituals, those family traditions really help protect kids and teens from a lot of anxiety and depression. So if that's your family ritual, is to go watch football, go do that. If it's to go outside and play a game, let's do that. Whatever those things are for your family, it's important for your kids to feel part of that.
Now, we talk about the meals and the importance of bringing the family together to converse and the other issues and the rituals that happen as well, too. But I understand, too, that there are a lot of advantages to be able to help deal with problems that may come up in the family. And this is an opportunity to bring some of these problems up or at least to kind of head them off, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so we know that the holidays can be stressful and family routines can kind of go a little awry, but those stressful days and moments are those things that are kind of short-lived. So we know that in Indiana, we're doing a fairly good job. According, there's a survey, it's called the National Survey of Children's Health, that says that about over 65% of Hoosier parents report handling the day-to-day demands of raising children fairly, very well, so they think they're doing all right. Mm-hmm. Most Hoosier families talk together when they're trying to solve problems, and they're likely to work together as a family all the time or most of the time, right? So all those things are pretty good. We just need to keep it up.
Now, I know a lot of this information, too, is out on the IYI website if you want to check it out that way, but also, too, that I understand there's some good ideas that you have helped bring up and talk about to parents and to caregivers about dealing with issues with young people to help deal with the opinions and some of the arguments that may come up at these big family get-togethers, as some of the arguments are good, some are not. But there's some things to think about, some tips that you mentioned, too, in the recent column.
Absolutely. Well, and we keep hearing that, you know, even for adults, the idea of civil discourse is important. But we can teach those skills to our kids so that we know that it's important to be able to have calm, balanced conversations with people that we don't always agree with. And so we have to teach them what that means, what that looks like. We have to model that for them. So some of those tips are teaching them to listen with patience, mm-hmm. so that instead of trying to think about how they're going to respond, they're actually hearing the words that the other person is saying. And so to build that empathy is really important. You have to go into it being willing to be wrong, understand that some people may have some facts or arguments that you haven't thought of before, and to be willing to accept that information. And then really just to have that respect for opposing views, to say we agree to disagree. It's okay, we don't see this issue the same way, but you're still a valuable member of our extended family or friend group, and it's okay that we don't see eye to eye on every issue.
That kind of goes along with that old saying that had been said years and years before, that may not agree with what you say, but I certainly defend to the death the right to say it. It's something important
Absolutely.
To keep in mind, too, I guess. So, well, Tammy, as always, thank you for the advice and the information. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Police seized an Indiana man's vehicle more than 5 years ago, and despite a U.S. Supreme Court and an Indiana Supreme Court ruling in his favor, he still hasn't gotten it back. Tyson Timms' $40,000 Land Rover was taken by police because he had used it to transport about $400 worth of heroin. His case was brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, where the High Court ruled that excessive fines apply to state as well as federal law enforcement agencies. And after that decision, the case went back to the Indiana Supreme Court. And just recently, the state court had ruled that the seizure of Timms' vehicle did constitute an excessive fine, and they created some new tests to help make the determinations of such fines in the future. Sam Gedge is an attorney with the Institute for Justice and represented Timms, and he says that the ruling is a move in the right direction.
The Indiana Supreme Court majority applied a much more nuanced and I think a much more reasonable test for determining whether taking someone's property is excessive.
But the victory doesn't mean that Timms' vehicle will be returned to him. The Indiana Supreme Court sent the case back down to the trial court from which it originated 5 years ago and asked the trial judge to apply the new tests that they have created to the Timms case. And Sam Gedge says that he's not sure how that trial is going to be conducted.
It's possible, I think, that the trial court could try to have another trial and try to hear new evidence with this new legal standard as the lens for looking at that evidence.
He says that there's typically a 30 to 35-day waiting period after a ruling before the case is sent back down to a trial court. The Greenways Foundation of Indiana is working with the state's Parks and Recreation Association to create the workshops that in turn will interest citizens and businesses in establishing what are called trail towns. In fact, the first workshop was held on Halloween Day in Portage. Mitch Barloga with NERPC is the board president of the Greenways Foundation this year. And he was on regionally speaking to talk about the trail towns concept and how it can boost recreation, tourism, and even a community's economy.
Trail towns is a concept that started out with the Great Allegheny Passage, which is in the Pennsylvania-Maryland area. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely long trail, and there were many communities that were located around it. And so the idea was, how do we make these communities more attractive for people on the trail to come and visit and to try to reap some economic benefits of the people using it? So trail towns grew out of that, and now it is kind of emerging through the East and coming this way. We have programs throughout Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and even into Michigan. Now, the Greenways Foundation, what we're trying to work with is a consultant out of Pennsylvania. Her name is Amy Camp, and she has been able to do this throughout the country and get communities and regions excited about the concept of trail towns. And so we're taking a big splash. We have organized 6 workshops throughout the state this year. And so the idea is to share with stakeholders in Northwest Indiana, and stakeholders is a very broad term. And in this case, you're talking about public entities, people who own businesses that may be around trails, and also just advocates in general and even users of the trail, to figure out how to best position communities to be attractive for people, for trail users. And a lot of people who use trails, again, the Great Allegheny Passage is kind of a tourist destination, mm-hmm. where it's nearly, 80 to 100 miles in length. So people are not going to take, a day trip. They're going to be out there for multiple days. So you have to accommodate these trail users with overnight accommodations, restaurants, and other places where they can enjoy and relax. And we just want to make sure that those tools are available to our communities too. We have over 160 miles of trail throughout Northwest Indiana. So conceivably, people can come here in this region and stay a night or two. And not even those who are visiting, just people that live here. If you live in Hammond, you might want to visit Chesterton. You could connect all the way through to Chesterton on trail today. And that's a pretty long ride. You're talking about 20, 30, even a 40-mile ride. And so people might want to stay the night in Chesterton, enjoy some of the restaurants out there. So we have to make sure that businesses can be bike friendly, and there are a lot of strategies for that, for accommodating bicycles and bicycle users. Restaurants are also in the mix of that as well. Discounts can be afforded. And so those are strategies we're looking forward to learning about during these workshops.
Was there anything you mentioned about the Allegheny Trail in particular in Pennsylvania? Was there anything in doing the research, learning about that trail and all of the opportunities that they made available for economic development along the trail, the places to stay for the overnights or places to eat or the like, other tourism that's probably located in very close by, I would imagine, to the trail? Were those ideas that they have put forth that you were able to want to put into this particular this series of trail towns, as you call it?
Yeah, and I'm not going to look at that because I'm not nearly as familiar with the Great Allegheny Passage. What I am familiar with is what's called the High Trestle Trail in mm-hmm. central Iowa near Des Moines. And I had an opportunity firsthand to take a look at what's going on out there. And the High Trestle Trail runs maybe 20 or 30 miles, but it's kind of in an isolated area of Iowa, but it gets a tremendous amount of tourist interest because they have this tremendous bridge that goes over basically a gorge with the Des Moines River. But there are nearby towns that have taken advantage of this interest, and they have accommodated people that use the trail. And I actually had the opportunity to visit a hotel, an old hotel that was restored, and it accommodates bicycles. It helps store bicycles. It provides services for people who are on bicycles, with repairs and with other types of accommodations. And so learning from that really opened my eyes to the potential of what we could take advantage of here in the region and really not only make our trails even more attractive to people living here, but also people that might want to visit.
So it's a jump in history, it's probably an extension of what was established when the Model T was out there on the very early highways, like the National Road and other highways as well, too, where you had stops along the way and you had places that would repair vehicles if there people were making the trek.
And that's exactly the case. You make an excellent point about a historical reference here. The Lincoln Highway in Dyer used to be the ideal section. It was mm-hmm. the first paved segment of highway in the United States. And there was a lot of hotels and restaurants that were built specifically to accommodate the motorists. Now, you have that today, but it's not, it's not nearly as friendly as it may once have been. And again, with trails, it is more of a personal issue. People are seeing people face to face here, and there's a lot of interaction. People that, work with each other on the trail themselves, and they are able to pass the information on to potential visitors to this region.
Now, is Amy Camp going to come over to each of the workshops, starting with the one on Halloween morning in Portage, and make all the other treks? Because we're talking basically Portage and South Bend. Bend, Fort Wayne, Evansville, Terre Haute, Carmel. She's covering the entire state.
She certainly is. And yes, she understands what's involved here. And there are some interesting travels that she's going to have to take care of. I think she's going from South Bend to Evansville in one day. And
oh my goodness.
Hopefully she's not going to put me off of her Christmas card list for that one. But even so, she is very eager to make this work, because what we want to do at the Greenways Foundation is use this as kind of a starting block for us to create a Trails Town program for Indiana, where we can work with communities on making sure that they are Trail Town certified, where we have certifications for different things like Tree City USA and Bicycle Friendly Community. Well, we want to start a Trail Town program. There's only one in the country that we know of that's on a statewide basis, and that's in Kentucky, that is being run by their tourism office. So we're looking to have that same type of energy afforded here in Indiana. With this program, hopefully what will come about is a better understanding from state officials at the DNR that these communities want to see trails connect, and we're going to see them on proposed maps and, again, with the Trail Town program going forward.
More information, by the way, about Trail Towns is available on the Greenways Foundation of Indiana website. Figuring out America's healthcare system can be hard for anyone. It can be especially challenging for refugees who often face significant language and cultural barriers. But one group is trying to bridge that gap by training refugees as health navigators in their own communities. And here's a look on a young woman who provides such healthcare lessons for fellow refugees from Burma. The report's from Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs.
At a small, sparsely furnished apartment in South Des Moines, Iowa, Sipo Ross sits in the middle of the living room's brown carpet. She carefully sets out stacks of papers.
We have pre and post tests, and then intake, sign-in sheet.
23-year-old Ra is in the home of a middle-aged refugee couple from Burma. She's here to teach them and their elderly neighbor about the flu and the common cold.
What kind of symptoms? Like, how can they spread, those kind of stuff.
The couple are dressed in colorful longi, a piece of fabric worn around the waist that's common in Burma. Their neighbor is still in her pajamas. They sit in the circle on the floor as Ra speaks. This small circle, as it's called, is part of Ra's job as a health outreach coordinator for a local nonprofit called EMBARC. That stands for the Ethnic Minorities of Burma Advocacy and Resource Center. Ra is also from Burma. She came to the United States through the official refugee program about 10 years ago. Like these refugees, she's Karin, one of the country's many ethnic minorities.
My family were first resettled in Lakewood, Ohio. We lived there for 3 years. I like it there a lot, but they don't really have a lot of refugee organization or support.
Now, Ra teaches Karin refugees about topics like the flu and mental health, which is rarely discussed in her culture. She says she has to explain concepts like stress and trauma.
In America, it's a big topic, you know.
Last year, more than 500 refugees were resettled in Iowa, including 128 from Burma. There are large groups in other Midwestern states as well. Nola Agner is with the Polk County Public Health Department. She says it's important refugees get extra help because they face major health issues from living in war-torn countries and refugee camps.
So it's a lot of just chronic health conditions. It's a lot of medical issues. A lot of times we're seeing individuals that are coming from the worst of the worst.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, refugees from Burma are susceptible to complex issues like hepatitis B, internal parasites, and malnutrition. They often have limited knowledge about these conditions and may need immediate attention. There are health workers statewide to assist them, but EMBARC's approach is unique.
Well, the big thing is that our health workers are actually from the community.
Mariah Morgan works with EMBARC's health program. She says refugee workers can catch assumptions and misunderstandings that American-born workers like herself might not get.
I might not realize that I need to take a couple extra minutes to define what, you know, tartar buildup is for your teeth, whereas they'll know immediately that this is going to be a new concept for my community, and I should probably take an extra minute to define it.
To become a community health worker with EMBARC, refugees first learn to be a medical interpreter. Then they go through a 40-hour training program. Ra says health coordinators like her are able to quickly gain refugees' trust.
Because we speak their language and we know their culture,
And this relationship can help refugees handle many details of their new lives. At the small circle in Des Moines, one of the Karen women asked Ra to translate a letter from a local hospital. Her daughter was recently in a car accident.
And then I was telling her this letter just to inform you that for her daughter, she has a little injuries.
On home visits, Ra spends a lot of time doing extra things like translating mail and making doctor's appointments. She likes doing it.
I understand what it feels like to be like in their place. When I first come to United States, I don't know any English, and all the culture and everything is very new to me.
Embark has 8 health workers who work with refugees from Burma, and more recently, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for listening, and we will be back with you with another program tomorrow.